It's The Morning Show. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. This hour, we're talking about land-grant universities, specifically about where that land came from and how it benefited white settlers at the expense of generations of Native American peoples. In the 1800s, the U.S. gave land taken from indigenous people to states so they could sell it and support universities. That happened across the country, including here in Wisconsin. Did you realize that's what land grant meant? What questions do you have about it? You can join in at 800-642-1234. When did you first learn about this happening? How do you think about indigenous homelands becoming seed money for colleges like the UW? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Robert Lee is an historian of the United States focused on indigenous dispossession and U.S. state formation in the 19th century American West. He teaches at the University of Cambridge. He co-authored an award-winning report for High Country News with Tristan Ottone. It's called Land Grab Universities, about the Morrill Act. Bobby, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me on.
You identified nearly 80,000 parcels of land, and they're across 24 states. So how did the U.S. government decide how much land each state would get?
Yeah, in order to, understand how much land each state would get, you need to know a little bit about the Morrill Act itself, right? It's passed in 1862, and it parcels out a cache of land or rights to land to each state to give to a university. It's how do you decide how much land each state gets? And what they wind up hitting on is doing it not exactly based on population, but roughly based on population. The formula that they used was based on the congressional size of a state initially in the 1860 census. So states would have a larger congressional delegation if they had more people. So larger states got more land. This is how New York, for instance, which has the largest population of any state in 1860, gets the largest allocation of land. Nearly a million acres, 990,000 acres is allocated to New York for it to sell off to support a land grant university. This goes all the way down to 90,000 acres for the smallest states.
And it's not just, you know, the state borders that we have in our minds now. Your research found more than 8,000 parcels of tribal homelands in Wisconsin were divided among roughly 30 universities in the Midwestern, Southern, and Eastern states. So how did they figure out which acres would go to which states?
Yeah, that's a great question. The Morrill Act wasn't just giving out differential allocations of land. They also made a distinction between the type of gift of land that was given by the federal government. So basically, there were two types, and it depended on the geographic location of the states themselves. States in the East, places like New York or Massachusetts, they got something that was called scrip. So scrip is a word for a type of coupon, basically to select land that had been expropriated from Native Americans anywhere on the public domain. So the public domain land is out west. This is the these are the squares that you see when a flight lands in Wisconsin when you're going over. So eastern states were given the right to select land anywhere in the West. Whereas Western states like Wisconsin, like California, they had to choose land from within their state borders because this is where the public domain was at the time. So the end result of this is you have a land rush to hot land markets in the 1860s and 1870s when this scrip is being doled out to the eastern states to support their universities. So a lot of them wind up going to places. They sell it. They generally sell these rights off to speculators. I mean, it's a complicated process of distribution. But the land tends to wind up getting selected in places like Wisconsin and in Minnesota, which had the largest, along with California, the largest selections of these scrip.
So states sold this land to benefit their universities. Where's the money today?
That's a great question, and it depends on the universities themselves. But for the most part, this money is still there. It often doesn't appear on the balance sheets or the annual reports of universities, because this is in the 19th century. This is maybe a few hundred thousand dollars, which is a tremendous amount back then, especially when you're a university that has, 50 students or 200 students. But today it's a drop in the bucket of a major university's budget. So you don't see it in the annual reports. But it's there. It's either held by the universities or it's held by the states. It has to be held by law in perpetuity. And the universities can generally just use the interest that's earned annually off of these endowments.
We're exploring how colleges profited from the sales of indigenous homelands. You're here on the Ideas Network. Our guide is Bobby Lee, an historian at the University of Cambridge and co-author of Land Grab Universities. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you remember being taught about this in school? How do you think we should explore this history? What do you think about these homelands that belong to Native American tribes that were then taken and sold for the benefit of United States universities? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can send your question or your comment to ideas@wpr.org. Bobby, the U.S. government acquired this land three major ways, we understand. There's seizure and treaty and unratified treaty. Treaties were the most common. How did people broker those?
The United States made hundreds of land cession treaties with indigenous nations across what is today the United States from the 18th century into the 19th century in 1871 when the treaty making with indigenous nations stopped. That was followed by treaty-like agreements, which were also made. These were diplomatic encounters, but they were ones in which there were power differentials. So the United States was more or less able to coerce these agreements. They're signed like treaties. They list various articles, the land that is being ceded, the various payments that might be being provided, either in cash or annuities or goods or the time of blacksmiths or gunsmiths. And they have a very formal structure to them. And there are hundreds of made. They cover most of what is today the Western United States, but there are significant portions that are covered by treaties like these that were made that were never ratified. And there are also significant portions of the United States that were just taken outright.
And even on paper, the U.S. government paid tribes less than $400,000 to settle land claims. But you found that the U.S. often didn't pay anything for the land.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, when land was just seized or when a treaty was never ratified, this is the case in California. It covers all of California, lots of parts of Nevada and up into Oregon, where the treaties were never ratified, the payments were never made. And so the land was just taken. And I should say, even when payments were made, they tended to be vastly below the value of the land at the time. So maybe a cent or 2 cents an acre for land that the United States would immediately value at a base rate of $1.25, right? And we were able to dig up all of those payments in order to figure out what each of the parcels were acquired for by the United States and what each of these parcels was able to provide for the endowments of land-grant universities in order to understand the differential between those two, which is really the core of the wealth transfer that's happening between indigenous nations and universities in the 19th century.
Well, an example of that is in Wisconsin. The largest land cession included part of Northwest Wisconsin. The U.S. government took more than 1 million acres from the Chippewa that benefited 33 land-grant universities, and you found that the Chippewa land netted university endowments about $3.3 million. Put that into perspective for us.
Yeah, in order to understand the what that means, you want to compare it to how much it cost the United States to acquire this land, which would be a tiny fraction of that. So in the case of something like the University of Wisconsin, you can have a multiple of something like 50 to 1. So for every dollar that is paid to acquire indigenous title. In the case of the University of Wisconsin, there were four treaties that applied to the lands that benefited the University of Wisconsin. And then a dollar is paid on average for each of those parcels, and then 50 times as much is made for the university. And then if you want to understand what that something like $3.3 million in 19th century dollars means today, you could go online, you can plug that into an inflation calculator, and you can figure out what that would be worth today. So across the entire study, all of the land-grant universities that we looked at, we found that these raised in principle a little bit over $20 million in the late 19th and early 20th century. And today that would be about $500 million in principle. This is before the resources are put to work earning money for the universities themselves.
Bobby Lee is an historian who co-authored the article Land Grab Universities. We're talking about what happened in the 1800s when the U.S. claimed land, pushed First Nations people out, and then used that land to generate seed money for higher education. What do you wonder about this? What do you want to know? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We're taking your questions about the Morrill Act, what happened then, and how it's working now. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Keely Boltina. This conversation continues on The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I bet you'll recognize the school's names. Cornell, Rutgers, the University of Minnesota, Colorado State, the University of Nebraska, the University of Wisconsin. These are just a handful of institutions of higher education that benefited financially from the U.S. government taking indigenous homelands and selling them to benefit new universities started by white settlers. We often call them land-grant universities. Our guest says it should be land-grab. This is The Morning Show. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. Our guest is historian Bobby Lee. He teaches at the University of Cambridge, and he co-authored an award-winning report about this for High Country News with Tristan Ottone. What do you want to know about this? What questions do you have as you learn more? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Maybe you're thinking about how colleges and universities can handle this today. Let's talk about it at 800-642-1234. Bobby, you wrote about the Dakota people in Minnesota as an example of how tribes and bands were coerced into signing these treaties with the United States government. What happened there?
The case in Minnesota, virtually all of the land that the University of Minnesota would benefit from through the Morrill Act came from the Dakota Treaty of 1851. So this is a treaty that is coerced in 1851, and then the annuities are held up. There is a time of starving and difficulty in the 1850s for the Dakota. There is an uprising, sometimes called the Dakota War, but it was really an uprising in the early 1860s. And the end result of that was that there was the largest mass execution in U.S. history in Mendota, Minnesota. And just a few weeks after this execution, the governor of Minnesota, he signs up to take the Morrill Act bounty in early 1863. They're able to acquire land during the Civil War. The University of Minnesota is shuttered because it's not doing well. It's heavy in debt. And this land brings the university back to life. So it's really a sort of stark example of how the resources, the land, the wealth, the resource transfer that's going on through the Morrill Act, you can see how that works to benefit universities at the expense of the original owners and caretakers and occupants of lands in places like Minnesota and Wisconsin.
This is another example of a time when the amount that the United States handed over for the rights to this land had an incredible return because they just paid so little for it. It looks like for every dollar of the United States that they spent to purchase the Dakota title, the Morrill Act gave $250 to the University of Minnesota's coffers. That's a ratio of 250-1. After this happened and the University of Minnesota benefited from this, what happened to the Dakota?
The Dakota are later expelled from Minnesota, and there's a diaspora into places like the North Dakota, into Canada.
We're talking about the history of land-grant universities such as the University of Wisconsin. Our guest is Bobby Lee, an historian at the University of Cambridge who co-authored Land Grab Universities. You can join in and ask your question at 800-642-1234. You can also send your question to ideas@wpr.org. Bobby, you mentioned Cornell earlier in our conversation, and that stands out among land-grant universities for just how it used the Morrill Act to raise millions. You mentioned Scripp earlier. You called Cornell University the Scripp King. What did Cornell do differently than some of these other land-grant institutions?
Yeah, Cornell really stands out for two reasons. I mean, one, because they got the most land. They got the largest portion of scrip through the Morrill Act, nearly 1 million acres. But they were also rather distinctive in the way that they were able to speculate in it. Essentially, how it worked is most of the scrip was sold to Ezra Cornell, the founder of Cornell University. And then he was able to speculate in that scrip. So they were able to get the initial purchase price from Cornell. And then he folded all of the profits from the speculation back into the university. So what Cornell was able to do was really supercharge the returns on the Morrill Act, on the Morrill Act endowment in a way that most other universities and none to nearly the extent that Cornell was able to do to really increase the benefit that it was able to amass. I mean, by the mid 1880s, I mean, you have to think Cornell. Cornell is one of the Ivy Leagues, but it's not the oldest one. It is founded in the 1860s to take advantage of the Morrill Act. And by the mid 1880s, in a time where there are hundreds of colleges in the United States, it quickly becomes the third wealthiest university in the United States. And it's all thanks to the returns that it's able to make on the scrip that it acquires through the Morrill Act.
I want to bring in Sandy from Williams Bay now. Hi, Sandy.
Hi. How are you?
Good, thanks. What are you thinking about in this conversation?
Well, here in my area, we have this area was acquired, Chicago was acquired in southeastern Wisconsin in a mid-19th century treaty with the Potawatomi Indians and other Indian tribes. And we still have a large land tract that is an old growth forest, has never been built on here on our very valuable lakefront property that's owned by the University of Chicago. And, you know, they're trying to sell it and rezone it residential for about $9 million. And we've been trying to save the land. We've talked to the Potawatomi tribe about it, and we just feel like, you know, there could be valuable archaeological discoveries in the land. Before the Potawatomi, there was the mound builders there, and before that, there was mastodons and other ancient archaeological artifacts. But, you know, it just feels like it's happening all over again. What happened to the Indians is it's still ongoing, at least with this land.
Sandy, thank you for bringing that up. And Bobby, what about this idea that some people might think this is in the past?
Yeah, I mean, this isn't in the past. This is an ongoing history. It's living in the form of the endowments that were raised, and it's also as the caller suggested, it can be living in the form of land that is retained by states for the benefit of universities. In a follow-up piece to the initial reporting that we did, we found that roughly 500,000 acres originally distributed through the Morrill Act in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, was never sold. It was held by the states, and it continues to be leased out and used in other ways to raise money for the universities. In fiscal year 2019, which was the one that we looked at, the residual holdings earned about $8.5 million for these universities. So this is very much part of a living history. The Morrill Act is one of these government initiatives that structures our lives today.
Our conversation continues about the history of land-grant universities and how they benefited from the sale of indigenous homelands, and in some cases are still making money off of those lands and rights today. Historian Bobby Lee stays with us on The Morning Show. Maybe we'll hear from you at 800-642-1234. The news is next. I'm Keely Boltina, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. At least 16 land-grant universities could still be making money off of land given to them after the U.S. government took it from First Nations tribes. It happened more than 200 years ago, and it still affects people generations later. The United States paid little or nothing for the land, and then it used the property to fund agriculture and mechanical colleges. This is The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina, in for Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking with Bobby Lee. He's an historian who focuses on what's happened when the U.S. authorities seized land and resources from indigenous people. And he's here to answer questions about what happened in the 1800s and what's happening today. We've got Cindy in Madison, who's ready to join our conversation. Hi, Cindy.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm wondering if you can talk about what action we can take now in the present as well as in the future, now that you've compiled this really important information, beyond what feels like kind of low-hanging fruit of prioritizing Indigenous students and admissions and prioritizing the hiring of Indigenous employees.
Cindy, thanks for that. And also, even that is a topic of discussion because it's not really happening in our universities right now. We'll get to that with Bobby. Bobby, what about that broader question? What can we do to try to make this right?
Yeah, I mean, that is the big question. I don't know if I would necessarily describe getting more Indigenous faculty lines and getting better resources to Indigenous students as low-hanging fruit. I think the low-hanging fruit on this story in terms of recognition is just coming to terms and acknowledging how the Morrill Act functioned to promote the prosperity of land grant universities. I mean, this was the goal that we had, and sort of we spent 2 years compiling this data to put together this report. It's a tremendous amount of material, but I'd also say that there's a lot more to be done. So the first thing I think you can do is acknowledge this history. And we're seeing this happening at some places. At Washington State University, they were the first ones to use the data that we had compiled to rewrite their land acknowledgement. There's something similar going on now at Texas A&M. Another thing that the story has done is it's sparked college admission stakeholders to think about what the next steps are, thinking about, you know, anything from free tuition or in-state tuition for Indigenous students, or in the cases of universities that are benefiting from land that they still retain through the Morrill Act, the return of land. There are some real world examples of South Dakota State University, which redirected the funds from the Morrill Act several years ago into student services and the creation of a new Indigenous student center. I mean, one of the big goals that we had in compiling this report was in triggering exactly these types of conversations. And some of them are going on in a number of initiatives that are now emerging at universities to look deeper into the stories of their own communities, their own institutions, connections to the Morrill Act. Because as much as we compile, there's still a tremendous amount that we don't know about how this act supported the growth of land-grant universities across the United States.
Cindy, thank you for launching this sort of solutions piece of this conversation by calling 800-642-1234. There's a line for you now. How do you think land-grant universities should respond today to their participation in the Morrill Act? What steps would you like to see toward reconciliation? Now's the time to call at 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email at ideas@wpr.org. Bobby, let's talk more about the things you just mentioned. The last thing you were talking about was this opportunity at South Dakota State University sending money from its Morrill Act land into programs and aid for prospective Native students. How is that working in practice?
Yeah, South Dakota State was really ahead of the curve. They were doing this before we started reporting on this. South Dakota State is one of the universities that still receives a significant income from the Morrill Act because it has retained, the state has retained some of the land. So the amount that it can lease for has increased with inflation, whereas a lot of these other endowments that were raised, especially with scrip in the 19th century, were sort of stuck in time at, you know, a few hundred thousand dollars, which was wonderful then, but doesn't add a lot to the operating costs of universities today. That's why we think of them as sort of seed money that got these universities off the ground. So in the case of South Dakota State, it's really the case that it's earning a significant amount of money off of the Morrill Act still that enables it to funnel it into the creation of a student center, the needs of Indigenous students. And from what I understand, they've also used this as a fundraising tool in order to obtain additional funds to be able to complete their student center and the other activities that they're hoping to do.
John from Ellsworth called but couldn't stay with us. John says, as a form of trying to further justice, John thinks all Native Americans should get free tuition in college as a symbolic way to help address this wrong. You know, your project noted that Indigenous people are often absent from land-grant campuses and curricula. For example, the University of Wisconsin-Madison enrolls more than 40,000 students every year. Fewer than 200 are usually Native American. What do you make of that?
Yeah, some of these the statistics are quite shocking. We aggregated them all on the project website, landgrabu.org. This is where you can find out the number of Indigenous students at the universities, the endowments that were raised, the size of the student bodies today. It really speaks to who these universities were built for, what communities they were meant to, they were designed to serve. Land-grant colleges, agricultural and mechanical colleges, the vision behind them was to uplift the sons of poor farmers and the growing industrial class, the white industrial class in the 19th century and into the 20th century. And you still see these legacies today at these universities where the populations of Indigenous students are tiny. And I think it's one of their priorities to increase and widen the community that they're serving. And this is only another reason to pursue those goals, I think.
We're examining how colleges profited from the sales of Indigenous homelands. We've got Bobby Lee here, an historian at the University of Cambridge, also co-author of Land Grab Universities. We're taking your calls, your questions at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about how this happened and the effects still today? How do you think we should explore this in classrooms today as part of our history? What steps would you like to see us take toward reconciling with the past? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We've got Todd from Milwaukee who wants to talk with us now. Hey, Todd.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I reject the fundamental premise underlying the professor's theory here. And it goes really to the idea that there needs to be a solution today. And the underlying premise is that, for example, the Dakota own the land in Minnesota, or that the Potawatomi, for example, own the land here in southeast Wisconsin. That's just historically not true. These were transient nomadic peoples who traveled regularly. They had different hunting, wintering grounds, and they themselves were conquerors who displaced other tribes who predate them. To get on this notion that we're going to rectify some type of historical wrong through today's moral judgment is a rabbit hole that you can never escape from. Are we
Todd, I just want to jump in here because I do want to make sure that we're able to address your concern that I'm using language that these tribes owned this land or that the United States, acquired it from them. And our guest, Bobby Lee, is an historian. Bobby, what do you make of Todd's take on this?
Yeah, Todd's expounding the sort of wandering tribes myth that 19th century Americans rejected. I mean, the treaties themselves were acknowledgement of the ownership of this land by the indigenous nations, the places like Minnesota and Wisconsin.
So what you're saying is that even officials then recognized that whether there were clear boundaries or deeds didn't matter, these populations lived on these lands and they belonged to them?
Absolutely. They lived on these lands and in some cases for hundreds of years, in some cases for thousands of years, but they were recognized as the homelands, as the sovereign territories of these nations under U.S. law, especially in places like Wisconsin and in Minnesota. It's just it's a myth of the late 19th and 20th century to look back and imagine the indigenous peoples of the Americas as wandering, as rootless, as not being able to understand or to lay claim to spaces. The United States depended on the claims that they made to spaces in order to justify its own claiming of these spaces.
What do you make of land acknowledgments recited at universities where speakers will recognize that campus land was previously possessed by indigenous people? You mentioned the University of Washington does this.
Yeah, land acknowledgments really have taken off in the last 10 or 15 years, not initially in the United States, in places like New Zealand, in Canada. And the idea behind them is to acknowledge the original owners of these places that we use and that we occupy today. But as critics have pointed out over the years, without any action behind it for reconciliation today, they tend to ring quite hollow.
Well, then what language could be used to better acknowledge land-grant universities' participation in the Morrill Act, or is this some sort of performative justice?
Yeah, it's not so much about the language. It's about what it's attached to, what happens after you use the language. One of the things that I hope to see come out of this research is a fuller acknowledgement in land acknowledgments that the universities are built not just on indigenous land, but oftentimes with indigenous land that's been converted into endowments. This land, as we were discussing earlier, is often hundreds or thousands of miles away from the institutions themselves. So I think good and accurate land acknowledgement statements are very useful. I just think that they are a starting point. They shouldn't be an end point. They should be something that opens up a wider conversation about what next steps are.
Historian Bobby Lee stays with us on the Ideas Network as we talk about what universities can do now, more than 200 years after they benefited from the U.S. seizing land from Native American tribes and then allocating it to fledgling universities. Still time for your question at 800-642-1234. What do you remember being taught about this in school? How do you think we could talk about this history and explore it in the classroom? 800-642-1234. I'm Keeley Boltina. This conversation continues on The Morning Show. Our guest and his co-author write that what land-grant universities do today can be leadership against genocide and dispossession of indigenous people, or they risk reinforcing racism that built this country. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina. We're taking your input. You can send your questions to ideas@WPR.org. Our guest is historian Bobby Lee, who's researched and written about how the U.S. took things from Native communities and turned them for profit and advancement. We're talking about what we do now, long after the 1800s, while people are still benefiting from the practices of the past. And Bobby, in an op-ed for the New York Times, you wrote that universities should stop, in your words, clinging to an origin story that starts with free land and acknowledge debts that are impossible to repay but unconscionable to ignore. What do you want to say about that?
Yeah, the Morrill Act was, it was couched as a donation. If you look at the letter of the law, this is described as a donation from the federal government to the states. But in order to understand it as a transfer of resources, you need to understand how the United States came into the possession of this land. It's not just the Morrill Act. There were thousands of land laws that were passed by the United States between the late 18th and the early 20th century that were engaged in a massive process of wealth transfer in which the United States worked to acquire this land on the cheap from the indigenous nations of the continent, used differential power to coerce agreements that brought the land into the public domain of the United States, then redistributed to things like schools, universities, to states for things like state houses, for prisons, of course, to individuals. This is a story we associate with this process most popularly, things like the Homestead Act, free land, right? The idea that there was free land. Now, for a long time, historians, especially historians of the American West, have rejected that sort of ternarian notion of free land underlying the democratic growth of the United States. I mean, there was no free land in the United States. There was only a form of wealth transfer that was happening. And in order to think about what the ramifications of that are today, we need to come to terms with how it happened and how it came to be.
We've got Mark on the line who has a question as we are talking about solutions here. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning. Issues. Is it the tribe itself that's implicated in the question, or is it the community members? Because of course we live as a group, different tribal members in geographic areas that are affected by this. So that's my question. Who has standing in the matter when it comes to Native people? Is it the community today, or is it the tribe that the Morrill Act was meant to target?
Mark, thanks so much for that question. And Bobby, what do you see about standing, whether that's legal rights or who should be speaking up about this?
I wasn't getting the first part of the question. It was coming in and out. Could you restate it, please?
Yeah, Mark was just wondering who has standing to pursue this issue. Is it the tribes or Native American students on campuses? I think we're trying to get at the idea of who actually gets to raise this as an issue and should try to affect change.
Yeah, I mean, if you're talking about standing in a legal sense, I mean, everything about how the Morrill Act worked was built into the legal structure. So it's all legal, and there was no standing, especially after the Indian claims cases of the 20th century. So this really is a political issue, and it's an ethical issue. The question is a good one of who has standing in that sense to raise this and to ask for change. And I think, I mean, from my point of view, especially as I got my PhD at a land grant university, I think it should be the communities who are affected by this wealth transfer. That is the indigenous nations who have been who have lost these resources, these legacy resources, and the communities at land-grant universities, the students, the staff, the graduates who have a stake in what these institutions stand for.
Bobby Lee, you are an historian. You just mentioned that you studied at a land-grant university for your doctorate, the University of California at Berkeley. After your research, do you feel differently about enrolling there?
Yeah, I think like a lot of people, I didn't know any of this history when I first started on my PhD. This isn't part of the story that we are told about land-grant universities, especially in the last 10 years when there was a sort of wave of 150-year anniversaries that would, you know, celebrate the Morrill Act and all it accomplished in terms of broadening education for lower-class students, things like advancements in science and technology, land-grant graduates. It shouldn't be lost on us today that land-grant graduates have been involved in the creation of vaccines that many of us carry in our bodies. But yeah, for me, and I think for a lot of other readers who I've talked to after we put out this story, it sort of pulls the veil back and lets you know that you're not sort of standing outside of sort of the imperial history of the United States. We're all a part of it who benefit from being U.S. citizens today.
How have you heard from people in Wisconsin and seen them respond to your research on the Morrill Act?
In Wisconsin, we've done a couple of talks and workshops at the University of Wisconsin, one in the fall of last year and one later this spring. And these were discussions exactly to talk about the things that we've been talking about the past few minutes, what can be done going forward. And it was really exciting, I mean, to hear the ideas when we go and do these talks and the research. I mean, one of the great ideas that I heard that I hadn't heard before from a Wisconsin stakeholder was the suggestion that tribal nations who were affected by the Morrill Act should have a hand in the admissions process, not just access to admission spots for members of their community, but having a hand in selecting who they might want to give a scholarship to attend one of these land-grant universities.
And what do you hope comes from your continued research?
Well, I'd really like to see more research into the land-grant university system. I mean, we really just scratched the surface here. We sort of constructed a view from 30,000 feet of how this large-scale process of redistributing nearly 11 million acres from 24 states to 52 universities, how it worked. But we still know so little about how this funding program was elaborated at each one of these schools. So one of the most exciting things for me as a historian in particular is to see this research being integrated into syllabi at land-grant universities, to see it being discussed at conferences and at workshops, and also to see these initiatives that have emerged at a number of universities, at Cornell, at the Ohio State, yeah, at the University of Connecticut.
Bobby, I'm going to have to jump in here, and we'll certainly be paying attention to what comes next. Want to thank Robert Lee, who's an historian, for talking to us about land-grant universities and where that land came from, tribal communities. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.